is the End User, episode 173 for Tuesday, June 3rd. A light sprinkle of speculation. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. Chris, we took a week off for Memorial Day here in the U.S. I had a great holiday. How was yours?
It was good. It was good. And then turns out we chose the wrong week to take off because now we have a boatload of news to talk about.
Well, I don't know. The main news, for me at least, is the Apple Worldwide Developers Conference. This is the 25th year of their conference, which kicks off in San Francisco. And they had their keynote earlier today. They live streamed it to Apple devices, and I was watching the whole thing start to finish. There was a ton of developer news. Unfortunately, no new products were announced this week, but even before that, during our week off, we found out that Apple has officially acquired Beats Music and Beats Electronics for a little over $3 billion.
And that turned out to be very much true, although it turned out to be about 3 billion or 3 Instagrams, as the regulars might know.
Right.
So we didn't get
any news about why Apple is buying Beats and what they're planning on doing with the platform. All we got during the keynote today was one of my favorite celebrity phone calls of all time, Craig Federighi, on stage called Dr. Dre from his Mac. And Dr. Dre said, "What time should I show up for work on Monday?"
Yeah, that was a interesting cameo, I guess. He's not even going to be full-time, they said, at Apple.
No, I don't think so, but they like to pretend that he was going through the standard orientation.
Standard onboarding process.
Craig told Dr. Dre, you don't want to miss the free t-shirt.
Yeah. So
there was a lot of other new stuff that they announced today. So this is their developers conference. So this presentation was very much focused on developers and what they could do with their software and what the new versions of OS X, which is called 10.10 Yosemite, and iOS 8, and all of the supporting systems that will go with it and allow developers to create new things. So there were just way too many features for me to be able to talk about all of them. But basically, they are planning on making all of their products and all of the apps that work for their products connect much better. So for one thing, you will see a lot more crossover between OS X and iOS with things like continuity, which links apps between iOS and OS X and allows you to do things like take phone calls or text messages from your Mac or your iPad. Once they go through your phone, it sends it over Wi-Fi to another one of your devices, which is crazy. Something called Handoff, which is continuously aware of whatever you're working on and where you're working on it. So let's say that I'm writing an email on my iPhone and I get to my Mac and I want to finish it there. It already knows that I was working on it and will transfer all of my unfinished work directly to the Mac. Or if I'm looking at a web page on Safari, I will be able to go immediately to my iPhone and it'll automatically know in the lock screen that I was working on Safari, and I can swipe right into Safari on my iPhone and look at the same web page. So lots of crazy integration like that. I mean, they showed off just these integration features for almost a half hour. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, that's they're really looking after the dream of the continuous client, right? Putting everything that you have and have been working on across all of your devices, assuming they're Apple devices, I guess.
Right. And so assuming you're in the Apple first party ecosystem, they are very much on the way to having exactly that, the platform agnostic client, the situational awareness of all of your devices.
And I believe for the iCloud Drive part of that, they were even planning on Windows support.
Yeah, that's right. So they already have a limited amount of cross-platform support basically through iCloud on the web, but they are adding full Windows support for not only iCloud Drive, but also for the new version of Spotlight. So they're revamping the Spotlight search feature and giving it a Windows app. So they're basically trying to compete with Windows Explorer now.
Yeah, I like that idea of them trying to compete with a File Explorer. It's pretty funny.
When I first got a Mac, I had no idea. Spotlight is really a superior search and navigation function to Windows Explorer, especially the search.
Well, and particularly on when you were coming from XP, it's much better in Vista and 7, but in XP, it was just nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
So
the iCloud is also expanding, and I guess the reason they're adding Windows support is because now you're going to be able to use it as a file drive, a direct file drive, so you can store files there. They're still going to be offering 5 gigabytes for free, but they're changing the pricing structure to a monthly plan. So now it's anywhere from 20 gigabytes for 99 cents a month to up to 200 gigabytes at $3.99 a month.
And that kind of makes sense. I mean, if you want to use it for 1 month and then drop it and then use it again, then it makes sense to charge a smaller amount per month instead of charging for the whole year up front.
Well, you may end up spending more than you think, because one of the things that they're doing, and this is an optional feature, but it's very much needed in my mind, is that they are moving your entire photo history from your iOS devices into the cloud. So up until now, they had a feature called Photo Stream, which would hold your last month's worth or last 1,000 pictures worth of photos. But now your entire photo library that were taken on your Macs are going to be stored in the cloud.
Right, so that's more of a backup of your entire repository of photos, right? That's a little bit different than what they were doing with
It's not going to back up your iPhoto library, but it's all of the photos that you're taking with your Apple devices.
Right, okay.
So if you have a professional camera or any sort of non-Apple manufactured camera, those photos will still be stored through iPhoto or however else you want to do it, whether it's Dropbox or Picasa and Google Photos or anything like that. But the photos you take on your iOS devices and potentially your Macs will be automatically uploaded to the iCloud.
So one of the more interesting things to me was the kind of subtle redesign of OS X. They talked a lot about their new design metaphor that they're kind of extending from iOS 7 into 10.10 Yosemite, and they're kind of carrying that flat design style over. What do you think of that?
Well, I wasn't able to really get as close a look of it as I would like. Even I think the pictures that have been popping up on blogs from the presentation today are not really giving me the design sense that I want to see. But for me and anyone else who is eager to jump into 10.10 Yosemite to play around with it, they will, as I believe we've mentioned before, they'll be launching a public beta of the program this summer, so you don't have to be a developer to have access to it. So I've already signed up for the preview when it becomes available, which should be sometime this month. And I'm really looking forward to that. And if you're worried about whether the new version of OS X will run on your Mac, they are once again including support for all Macs that ran Mavericks, which included all Macs that ran Mountain Lion. So even my mid-2007 MacBook Pro will still be eligible to upgrade to Yosemite for free.
Yeah, and that continues their what they've been doing in recent years. They've really changed that from their old model.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible. And they noted at the beginning of their keynote how effective that's been for adoption rates. It's a really, really high adoption rate for anyone who has eligible computers for Mavericks. They have something north of 40% are already running Mavericks.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a free update, why wouldn't you do it? The updates of years past have been full of friction, and just the whole upgrade process is kind of fraught with danger. And I think they're trying to get away from that and move in smaller chunks.
I hadn't found too much danger in it, no more or less than it was before, but it's certainly a lot cheaper. I think the main hurdle people now is that so many people bought computers running Leopard or early versions of Snow Leopard and have just yet to update their software to the point where they can freely access Mavericks or Yosemite. And they're afraid to do that because they don't even know if the DVDs are available. They are still available, but it's a big hassle to go out there and buy a DVD, which is the whole reason that Apple was switching to online-only upgrades in the first place. But it does exclude anyone who didn't make it to the point where they have the App Store.
All right, so they also made some changes to the Notification Center. What did they do there? This looks pretty cool.
It is pretty cool, but I didn't think that it was as interesting as a lot of the other things that we've seen. But they added a new Today view, which shows your calendars, your reminders, stuff like that. And it also allows you to add other widgets. So there aren't all that many widgets available yet, but I'm sure once Yosemite hits its final release, there will start to be more and more. And this may actually mean the end of the traditional home of widgets. It's the dashboard in OS X. And this is sort of the beginning of for dashboard widgets now that we're seeing all these Notification Center widgets.
Yeah, and that kind of makes sense. I would have to imagine that the dashboard is going to go away over time. Do you think they'll remove it from this release, or do you think they'll wait for a little bit?
They may remove it in one of the later updates, but I don't think it will be gone at launch.
Okay.
Although maybe it did. They didn't really talk much about dashboard.
Yeah,
not sure.
I wonder. That is an outstanding question we'll have to ask you when this actually comes around.
Right. So they also showed off some improvements to Safari. They've added their own brand new JavaScript compression engine, which they say is faster than anyone else's. And they are also very proud of Safari's memory and battery management. So it's a very efficient browser. And I've always found that to be the case, and they're saying even more so. They showed off Mail, which has a lot of new features. Like they've added a new first-party support system for attachments that will automatically send secure large file attachments when certain mail clients may not be able to otherwise, as long as you're sending it from one Mac to another. Or there's also a feature to send it from a Mac and then upload it to a website hosted by iCloud where someone with another email client could download it. Sure. So they're trying to get around those attachment file size limits that are the bane of many network administrators and clients.
Well, it's like a very seamless version of Dropbox, right? You just write the link into the email, and if it needs to upload it somewhere and provide a link instead of actually attaching it, it'll just go ahead, recognize that, and do it for you.
Yeah, I guess. I didn't get a sense of whether it worked that way, but it sounds like you did.
Yeah, that was the impression I got, at least.
So they're saying that they're going to launch a new Photos app. It won't be available when they launch Yosemite, but it's going to come sometime in early 2015. And it's unclear as to whether this is going to replace iPhoto or if it's going to be more focused towards that iCloud photo feature that I was talking about. But it's a more image-centric experience with some simple adjustment tools. And, well, we won't see it for a while, so I bet that there's a lot more work that they're going to be doing on it.
Yeah, but iPhoto is creaky at this point in time. They would do really well to replace it with something, I think.
iPhoto has been getting continuous updates, you know, since its inception, and it's still current. They last updated late last year, and it's got new features. It's great. It works really well. But yeah, it is not optimized for use with the iCloud management of your photo stream, and so I do understand why they're looking to something else. But iPhoto is a pretty powerful tool for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, it's a borderline power user tool. You know, they roll it into the operating system for everybody, but it's really a quite powerful, actually.
It's quite powerful, yeah, but their power user tool is Aperture, and that is a direct upgrade from iPhoto.
Yes, yes.
So we've been talking about this for 20 minutes or so now, and we haven't even talked about the new features in iOS 8. Certainly, some of these things are cross-platform, like continuity and handoff, things that I mentioned before. But they announced a whole new swarm of features for iOS 8. One would be the health app, which is sort of like Passbook for health, but it's a new thing. And their main goal here was to use this app to connect to other apps and other sources of information for your health. So they have already built in support for certain Garmin and Fitbit and Nike apps and fitness trackers. And they're also building in support to connect to actual hospital and healthcare organizations that health information there, and be able to communicate that securely and have you access it all from iOS. They also launched a home automation API called HomeKit, and they have sort of the same goal in mind there. They are not developing any home automation technology right now, but they want to help consolidate it. The way they explained it was they noticed so many different companies, you know, that we've seen like Nest and Quirky and Philips Hue, who are making home automation technologies that all connect to their own apps.
And I wish they had gone further in the announcement with this, because it seems really interesting. I don't quite know, you know, like what systems this is going to integrate with. They mentioned something about it being a protocol, and it, you know, we're not sure whether it's their own protocol or if they're just kind of sponsoring things like they did with FireWire, or we're not quite sure what's going on there. But there's going to be some notion of tying into home automation systems.
Yeah, I would have loved to hear more about it as well, but there was already so much in this presentation.
Yeah, it was packed.
Well over 2 hours long. But my impression is that it is an API that they have developed themselves, and that it's going to be up to the developers of the apps and the hardware to connect into their API. And possibly there'll be some more first-party support for that. But they did mention a lot of features, such as having certain schemes and commands and Siri integration. So they said it was specifically built into the API that you would have the ability to ask Siri to set certain commands based on schemes that you set up that could make changes across multiple home automation platforms simultaneously.
Yeah, and I got the impression, now they didn't say this keyword, but I got the impression that they were going to do Z-Wave integration.
They didn't mention too many companies by name. Yeah. There was just one slideshow screen with dozens of companies on there, and so I didn't see if Z-Wave was on there.
Yeah, well, I don't know. So we'll have to wait and see what that actually is. But that is potentially very intriguing. You know, we saw Microsoft form a partnership with Insteon the last time we talked, and it looks like Apple is starting to dip their toe in the water as well. So I'm gonna say that in the next 2 or 3 years, this home automation thing is really going to start to find its way to the mass consumer in a way that it just hasn't previously. And I think we're seeing Microsoft and Apple in this case start to recognize this.
And Google as well. Yeah, we're certainly seeing a sea change in the sort of major tech company support for these smaller home automation companies, which is great And it's awesome. So yeah, there will hopefully be a lot of movement around that in the next few years. So another API that Apple announced is a 3D graphics development kit. I guess this is supposed to be the iOS version of OpenGL or another big graphics development, but they're calling this one Metal, which is, for lack of a better word, really metal.
Yeah, they're saying that you know, you're getting graphics acceleration close to the metal, I guess is the idea.
Uh-huh.
So they're saying this is going to be, you know, a really low level and fast kind of API.
Right. So they're upgrading their keyboards with a whole bunch of new features, and the main one is called QuickType. And this is basically, it looks to be a variation on the keyboard that I see on almost everyone's Android phone. It's got more predictive text. It allows for a swipe style dragging keyboard, and but they've gone a few steps beyond that. For one thing, it predicts your responses based on the messages that you receive from people. So if someone asks you a question that has "or" in it, you will automatically be given the option of either the one thing or the other, just as forward responses. And beyond that, it actually learns your communication style with each of your contacts and makes individualized typing suggestions for each contact.
Yeah, that seems like a really smart thing to do. I'm kind of excited to see how well that works.
On top of that, if you want to ditch Apple's keyboard entirely, they are now allowing you to swap out their keyboard for someone else's, which was previously reserved for Android phones and jailbroken iPhones.
Yeah, I think you're a little too mild-mannered about it. This was like the holy grail of iOS, was trying to get a new keyboard on there. That's kind of a big deal. You know, it seems like a minor thing, but just them opening up some of these kind of features is indicative of a larger movement in Apple.
Right, and I totally agree, although I'm really excited about this new first-party keyboard. It seems pretty great, and I'm just really hoping that there are some more minor things about the keyboard that will be updated. Like, for example, they know when you accidentally hit keys and replace it with other keys, but at no point during the iterations of autocorrect over the years that I've had iPhones, at no point did they realize, hey, what if somebody hit the backspace key by accident?
Yeah, or
so I'm hoping that gets thrown in there.
The other one that gets me is if you hit period by accident, because then it starts sentence.
That's been corrected.
Okay, it still happens on Windows Phone.
Yeah, so Windows, Microsoft's got to get on that too.
Yeah, they got to get on the bandwagon.
Okay, so I could keep going on about these new features forever, but some of the ones that I didn't mention were they have widgets in the notification center now. They have extensions and apps, much like Safari and Chrome have extensions. All iOS apps can now get extensions to connect to other apps, which is pretty amazing, so that you can do something in one app based off another app. Like you can pin something from a Facebook app, or you can use a drawing app inside the Photos app. And they have also launched a whole new family management package inside iCloud and the iTunes store, which allows you to manage payments on other phones, iCloud sharing. You can actually have permission sent from one phone to another to either purchase or open an app, and you can do things like share iTunes content, share credit cards, and like I mentioned before, the thing that I just think is really cool is if you have an iPhone, if you get text messages or calls on the iPhone, they can automatically be routed to all of your other devices, which is something that was happening with iMessage and FaceTime before, but the fact that they can do it from the phone is so cool.
Yeah, I also wanted to talk about, you know, as this is a developer conference, they also announced some pretty big platform kind of things. And
yeah, that's right.
One of them
I almost forgot about that.
One of them is an entirely new programming language called Swift, which from what I can see, I looked at it for just a little bit. It seems to be a modern, high-level computer language. And coming from Objective-C, which they mentioned was 20 years old at this point, that is not what the previous iPhone development experience was like. And Apple's been able to kind of get around that by providing first-class tooling. But there, the Objective-C was kind of a rough language to... it was kind of a rough language, weirdly, for a modern platform. And I think with the introduction of this programming language, they're really going to have better ease attracting newer and younger developers, as if they needed the help in the first place. But it just, I look at it and I think, well, okay, now I think I could go develop an iOS app without gouging my eyes out with a spoon.
Yeah, I've started to think the same thing, and I'm really excited about the possibilities of Swift. I mean, just the demo that they gave of working with the Swift developer tools in Xcode was, it was crazy. I mean, a guy built a fully functioning app in about 30 seconds.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm extremely excited to see them kind of get modern with a brand new language for both iOS and for OS X. That is definitely a welcome thing to see.
Yeah, me too. So I'm really excited about that. But yeah, mainly it's the developers who are excited about that.
Yes, and so, yes. Well, we're excited about it in a way that what it enables developers to do more quickly is give us things that are novel more quickly, right?
Right. So Swift is already available. They have launched the developer toolkits. They've launched a number of publications explaining how it works. And as soon as Yosemite and iOS 8 launch their app stores, they will be already demonstrating and accepting new applications built in Swift. And it works alongside Objective-C.
Yeah, and I get the impression, and they didn't say this obviously, but if you want to do Objective-C, you can go ahead, but that is probably not going to be the future. And they're going to support both for a while, and I'd have to imagine that they're trying to sunset Objective-C kind of slowly over time.
Yeah, it will be a while. I mean, it will be a very long transition, probably longer even than the switch from PowerPC to Intel processors, which was ended up being about 3 or 4 years. But so this will probably be 5 years at least.
So now you will see developers with 5 years worth of Swift experience on their resume, even though it's only a day old.
Yeah.
All right. Well, should we? What do you think about the kind of bigger notion of this is really Apple opening up in a way that I don't think they would have if Steve Jobs were still at the helm. I think this is Tim Cook's Apple now, and I think we're starting to see him do some reasonable things in opening up the platform a little bit. What do you think? I feel like that's a pretty big sea change.
Yeah, I think some of this is definitely moving a little bit faster and in a little bit different direction than what Steve Jobs would have been comfortable with, but this is clearly a smart move for the future of Apple. And the way I see it, Apple spent most of 2012 and 2013 focusing on creating new products, completely redesigning their entire product line, and figuring out what the future was going to be in terms of the things that they sell. And then they've been focused for the last year or so on really working the development side of that. And we're seeing that pay off today. They want to create a unified, smart, futurist experience that takes advantage of all of their strengths and gets developers to create what people want, right? And they are throwing a ton of resources.
Yeah.
At just creating these developer tools. That's most of what we saw today, was just tools for developers to do things that no one's ever done before.
Yeah, and their own applications, their in-house applications, presumably, well, maybe using some of the tools that they were building in the first place. But we saw saw a sweeping developer change in all of the software, including all of the in-house software.
Absolutely. So that's what they
first-party software.
Right. That's what they were focusing on first, getting their first-party software in order. And then most of what we've seen since from 2013 to now was iterative changes, smart changes that are taking advantage of the rest of the work that they're doing on developer tools and implementing those across their first-party software so that people can see what it's like. But this is really all about enabling developers to create the software of the future in a really smart, intensive way. They clearly put a ton of work into this. And so it's really exciting. Now it's Apple did the hardware, then Apple did the software. Now it's up to people to program the next generation of apps. That's sort of my takeaway from today's announcements.
All right. Well, do you have any last words on the Apple news? I think we've gone through it all, but it's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, like I said, I could keep talking about it all night.
Yeah.
I think we hit the highlights, and we got to move on because we have other things to talk about. Microsoft has not been standing still these last 2 weeks either.
No, they have not. So this was pretty much from last week, and we've seen the announcement of the new Surface Pro 3. So turns out that this is a 12-inch device. It's a pretty dense 2160 by 1440 display. And what's a little interesting is that they changed the aspect ratio of the device. So you remember the Surface was kind of awkwardly 16:9, and I actually kind of liked the 16:9 tablet. But if you wanted to make that thing any bigger, then it was kind of unreasonably wide as just a tablet. So they've changed the aspect ratio.
Yeah, it was kind of odd to try to use it vertically.
Right. It was weird.
Turn it on its end, and it's awkwardly tall. But I don't understand why they made the tablet bigger and then also change it to a ratio that would be more comfortable to hold. Because if I'm holding this giant tablet upright, it doesn't matter that the aspect ratio is better. It's still 12 inches across. I think the Surface has always been and remains to be, even though they changed it, it remains something you have to put on a Surface.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think part of the focus of their announcement was they kept calling it lappable. You know, like, this is a laptop replacement. This is not a tablet kind of device. This is an Ultrabook competitor.
Yeah, I absolutely understand that. It is a laptop replacement. I don't like the word lappable.
But yeah.
They could have kept it a laptop replacement at 16:9. They didn't have to go the old iPhone ratio of 3:2. And they sort of went the other way. Like, they were trying to say this is a laptop replacement, but this is also an iPad replacement. But I do not see this as a good replacement for a tablet. Most Android tablets have migrated smaller than iPads, and iPads have been getting smaller and smaller. And Microsoft said, let's just go bigger than everyone and call it a tablet.
Well, yeah, that's the weird part about it, is you look at it and you think, well, okay, this is an Ultrabook competitor, right? So clearly when I pay $799, which is the entry price Surface Pro 3, clearly that comes with a keyboard, right?
Oh boy, that's not with the keyboard?
That is without the keyboard.
Okay, well, like, in a year, they'll ship with the keyboard.
Yeah.
Cheaper than the iPad, right?
They'll realize the error of their way. But I mentioned it off the cuff, but $799 is the starting point for the Core i3 version. And at the very top end, you have a Core i7 version, which is a little over $2,000, and that's with the keyboard.
Wow. Yeah, you can't get an iPad for that.
Yeah. There's no, maybe you'd have to get it, bejeweled with diamonds or something.
Well, I mean, even the 13-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display, it has a similar resolution density display, a larger screen, similar battery life, actually a little bit better, and it's cheaper than that high-end model.
Yeah, that is the maxed-out version. It's kind of unreasonably expensive. So they've also updated the battery life. They're saying it's a 9-hour battery, and in real world, it's probably going to be somewhere around 7 or 8, something like that. So that's good to see. You can use that all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, right? Just barely.
Yeah, most routes of the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, depends on where you're going, I guess. And they've also updated the type cover to have a larger trackpad. And,
well, that makes sense. They have more room to move around that cover.
And they've also, this cover's interesting. There's a couple things going on with this. You can attach the cover and you can kind of tilt it up a little bit and attach the magnets on it to the screen so that the keyboard ends up tilting back a little bit. And supposedly that is going to be more comfortable while typing. I'm unconvinced of this, though.
Huh, I have a hard time picturing that.
Yeah, it's just like unfolding the legs of a normal keyboard, right? So it's just got a little bit of angle to it.
Oh, okay.
But instead of unfolding the legs, you're kind of attaching it to the bezel of the device.
Magnetically?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, sure. It sounds more comfortable.
So it's kind of hard to explain. If you see a picture, you'd get it immediately. And the other big thing is that the kickstand now no longer has hard stops in it, which is kind of wild. Previously they had a kickstand that had two starting positions, or you would, you know, fold it back and it would lock into place twice before there was no room left. And this thing apparently doesn't have those catch points, so you can fold it back in any degree angle that you want.
Can I still maliciously break it off by pushing it too far?
Oh, yes. That is absolutely an option, although you might not want to do that for the $2,000 Core i7 edition.
It's not going to be mine, so I kind of do want to do it.
So it'll go from 0 degrees right up to 150 degrees. So I thought that was pretty cool. And I guess last thing here, it also includes the capacitive pen. So I imagine a comic book artist using this device and being very happy about that.
Yeah, I could absolutely see that.
So all in all, I think, you know, it's nothing earth-shattering. It's a new Surface Pro. It's a little bit bigger. They changed the screen size. But, you know, they're really kind of iterating over the previous Surface Pros that they had in the first place, and they're kind of taking away the smaller pain points, like the kickstand locking into two positions instead of infinite positions. So they're slowly improving the Surface, and I think they've realized that what they really want this to be is a laptop replacement, and I feel like they're embracing that a little more than they were previously.
That does seem to be the case. I haven't heard any mention of a 10-inch Surface Pro 3. Is there one?
No, this is the only one they've announced at this time, at least.
Is there a Surface 3?
So that's the question, is what is going to happen to the regular old Surface, the ARM version of the Surface? And I guess we don't know yet. We don't know. They were quiet about it. We don't know what. If they're going to release a new one, we don't know if they do, when. We don't know anything about that.
Because I like those a lot better.
Yeah, I think they're probably going to do something, but I doubt what you're going to see is just an iteration over the old Surface. I think they're probably rethinking this in some way and releasing it at a later point in time.
Interesting.
So, I don't know, we'll have to wait and see if they ever, you know, mention it. I don't know. We'll see. But, you know, at this point in time, there are a ton of Windows 8 tablets that are out there and are competent and kind of doing the job of the cheaper option that Microsoft could have released, right?
Right.
So, I've got a pet theory, and you can call me crazy if you want, but I think they've got an option here, and I think they've realized that what they really wanted to do was go after Ultrabook replacement territory and not the tablet territory, at least not with their current Windows 8 solution. But I do wonder if something is going to happen that's new that we haven't seen with software on a Microsoft-produced ARM device. So, you know, I'm not saying they're going to scale Windows Phone up, but I think they're going to do something a little different than what they've been doing.
something that would kind of take Windows RT in a different direction.
Yes, I think they're I think they don't know yet, first off, and I think they're kind of reevaluating their place in the hardware market as it is.
Well, sure. They're still testing the waters, so it makes sense that they would reevaluate every once in a while.
Yeah. So I'd have to imagine
they've been doing a lot of reevaluating recently.
So there's a bunch of questions out there. You know, is Windows RT dead or not? And you know, I think that the Windows RT that we know it as today might not live on. But I bet you they're thinking about it, and they're going to do something in that space, and we just don't know what yet.
Okay.
So, but that is wild speculation, which I guess has no room on the end user, does it?
A little bit of wild speculation.
Okay, we can just do a little bit.
Just a seasoning, a sprinkle.
A light sprinkle of speculation. All right, well, shall we sprinkle on the afterburners? We can get going a little faster, and as long as you have your seatbelt fastened, we can get in there.
Seatbelt fastened. Let's kick on the afterburner.
So in this week's The End User public service announcement, eBay is urging all of its users to change their passwords after they have leaked their database. We've seen this before, and we know what to do, and you just have to go change your password. And if you are not using a password manager, this is my time to tell you that you should be using a password manager so that things like this are easy. And now is your time to change your eBay password.
Cool. Now, starting June 6th, you'll be able to order the Asus Padfone X on AT&T for $199 on a two-year contract, or $22.92 a month. And it's sort of a smartphone-tablet hybrid that is only a 5-inch 1080p display, and there is a larger tablet version that is a 9-inch 1080p display. And so relatively cheap, new, interesting phones. The idea is that you put the phone into, it just slides into the back of the tablet, and you can use them both concurrently. They probably still won't be as unified as an iPad and an iPhone, though.
Yeah, it's kind of a wild idea, isn't it?
It looks cool.
So Windows Phone 8.1 has gotten a new official app, and it allows you to manage all of the files on the device. So, you know, instead of going into the various apps and looking at it through that lens, you can kind of go in and see where all your files are, and you know, see the files on your phone and your SD card and so on. You know, sometimes you just have to look at the files. Most of the time, you probably don't want to, but sometimes you need to do that. And now there's a first-party app that allows you to do that kind of thing. So it's a super minor thing, but good to see.
And next month, Apple will probably be launching Spotlight for Windows Phone.
Yeah, bring it on.
No, probably not. But in more exciting news, SpaceX had a press conference last month where they officially announced their Dragon V2, which will be their manned space delivery vehicle, or space taxi. This is part of their ongoing contract with NASA to deliver supplies and crew to the International Space Station. And they have announced their first crew, which will be launching in 2017 or so.
Yeah, you should take that and be the first person to make a gin fizz in space.
I would have to do some terrestrial gin fizz experiments first. I will give it a go if I can.
So speaking of gin fizz in space, you might be able to make one in your new Google car pretty soon. Although, not really. This is...
It goes to space?
No. It's just a self-driving car. The common element was the gin fizz, not the space.
Right. Well, so this is Google's first self-driving car that's built from the ground up. Up until now, they've just been modifying existing commercial vehicles. So this one doesn't have a steering wheel in it.
Well, so they're planning to roll out about 100 prototypes. Those things will have steering wheels in it, but their plan in the long term is to remove the controls from the cabin and give you like a touchscreen or something. So this is basically, we've got some pictures of the first prototypes of that class of vehicle. And as a bonus, it looks like kind of like a koala.
According to Google's blog, these prototype vehicles will not have steering wheels, accelerator pedals, or brake pedals.
No, so the first prototypes, they will have controls inside of them, but that's only temporary.
Okay, well, yeah, I'm looking forward to the cars that don't have any human controls at all. Yes. I like the Google's plan. It's just, there's a go button and a panic button. The panic button just, it pops down oxygen masks from the ceiling.
All right, well, I'm going to pop down some oxygen masks from the afterburner. We can turn it off. We'll get into the end user stories, and we've got another security-related item up front here. Some bizarre happening with TrueCrypt. I know we've talked about TrueCrypt before, and that is a program that allows you to encrypt the contents on your hard drive. But TrueCrypt.org is their website, and if you go there now, it actually has a big red banner at the top that says, "Warning, using TrueCrypt is not secure, as it may contain unfixed security issues," and it recommends that you move toward Microsoft BitLocker. And then they also have instructions for the Mac encryption software. So this was kind of the open source darling of the community, and this was open source software built by anonymous developers, and that was kind of the way that they were able to not get found out and, you know, not served a national security letter or something like that that would force them to, you know, put a back door in it or whatever. But it's very strange that all of a sudden they've taken the site down. They had one last release, and the release was signed with the developer's keys, and I think it's very strange. It's like they got spooked or something like that, and they said, "Well, no, this is over." So, you know, who knows what the actual story is? I hope we get to hear the actual story over time, but it's just truly bizarre.
Yeah, me too. I hope we hear the story in a good way. I hope they don't just make a bad movie about it. So yeah, other than that being weird and it's uncertain about what the future is, and if you're using TrueCrypt, you may want to think twice or not, or who knows. Anything else on that story?
Well, I think what we're going to see happen soon is we're going to have some open source alternatives. Because, you know, from a security perspective, if you really want to ensure that the encryption on your hard drive is not compromised in any way, you really want it to be an open source solution that people can look at, people can audit. And TrueCrypt was exactly that. And I think we're going to have to get some developers to pick up the project and move it in a different direction. But it's hard. If you are concerned about that, it's hard to recommend going to a closed source version of this. So a lot of people are kind of left stranded here.
So TrueCrypt has picked up a new development team, but are they taking it closed source?
No, it's just down for the moment until we get some more information.
Right. Well, but there is already a plan and a team in place that is working on reactivating it.
Oh, yes. It was that happened quite recently, but it's a separate effort that. It's not the original developers.
Oh, well, sure. I mean, that's granted. I mean, clearly the original developers were spooked and wanted to be completely dissociated from this project.
Yeah. And there's also a public audit happening of TrueCrypt, and because we saw what happened with OpenSSL and the Heartbleed vulnerability, so that doesn't happen to TrueCrypt. There was a team that was also auditing the software, so they are also going to continue with the audit, even though this bizarreness has happened.
Right.
So again, once everything shakes out, we'll see what happens. We will probably have something that is still usable. But it may not be TrueCrypt in its current form.
Well, Macs have File Vault, which I'm not sure if that's open source. It probably isn't.
No, I don't think it is. And neither is BitLocker, obviously. All right, well, let's move from security into some net neutrality news. It never ends. What's going on here with Verizon?
It never ends, and it's never going to end as long as this stuff keeps happening because these companies are have been dismantling net neutrality bit by bit, and that's bad for all of us, and I want everybody to keep hearing about it from me, even if they're annoyed. Don't be annoyed at me. Be annoyed at the giant companies that are doing it with no regard to the future of the internet or the economies that take place over the internet, which is all of them. So this one is actually kind of a minor story, so I'll try to keep it brief, but it's pretty simple. The rules of net neutrality have been determined not to apply to the major internet service providers in the United States because they were not technically classified as common carriers, and the rules governing net neutrality only applied to common carriers, of which Verizon and its cohorts are not. But Verizon's Fios business entity, now this is just the terrestrial broadband fiber network that Verizon runs, not Verizon as a cell phone company or as a traditional copper landline telephone company. Verizon Fios has been claiming public utility status to get benefits that only apply to public utilities. Now, what we're seeing here is Verizon is arguing that it is not a public utility when it benefits it, and that it is a public utility when it benefits it. So they are saying two things, and public utility and common carrier, yeah, they're not the same thing, but they mean the same thing. They are supposed to mean the same thing. And we're seeing Verizon, and probably other companies as well, being two-faced about their role in the information economy in a way that is clearly designed to make them money, and they are otherwise dismantling laws that would prevent them from making more money. So that's it. There's no more to the story than that this week. Ars Technica has a lot more in their article about it, which is based on a report from a consumer advocacy group that got a hold on some FCC communications. And it is, I want to be clear again, what Verizon is doing is not illegal. It's perfectly fine. There's a difference between a public utility and a common carrier, and it's taking full advantage of the law. But at the same time, it's spending a lot of money to shape those laws, and the laws are very much going in the way that they want them to. And they're making a lot more money off of it, and we, the consumers, are suffering. Even if you don't live in the United States, you will eventually feel some pretty significant effects from these laws.
Yeah, so what they're saying here is that there is a difference between the actual infrastructure fiber optic wire and the Fios TV and internet services that Verizon provides. So the actual infrastructure is covered under the common carrier laws, but their services, as they are, that happen to run over those wires aren't under common carrier law. That's an interesting legal hack.
I was going to say completely preposterous, but yeah, interesting legal hack is another way you could put it.
Yes.
All right, so I'm done with that, but unfortunately my green tech story is another kind of curmudgeonly one. And you may be surprised to hear this, because I'm going to be talking about the new draft rule from the EPA that they are saying their plan is to institute a 30% cut in carbon emissions by 2030. From the levels of 2005. So we are actually already a little bit below 2005, and so they're trying to get the rest of the way to 70% of those emissions just for power plants. Now, everybody is saying, well, almost everybody that I've read is saying, this is fantastic, this is wonderful news, things are being done. The Supreme Court has decided that under the language of the Clean Air Act, greenhouse gas does constitute a pollutant, and carbon dioxide is known as a greenhouse gas emission. But 30%, and really we're talking about of current levels, 25 or so percent, it's not good enough. The polar ice caps are melting irreversibly. We are on the brink of huge amounts of methane being released into the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And so if we have 1.5% of the methane being released that is not offset by that 30% cut in carbon emissions, we are still at a wash. And what we are doing is still adding a net high volume level of greenhouse gases into the air, regardless of whether we do this or not. This is not the limit of what we can achieve technologically or scientifically. It is not the limit of what we can achieve economically if we really put our minds to it and set the regulations as they need to be in order to prevent a catastrophe, which may be unpreventable at this point. And even if this raises power prices, you know, maybe that can get the emissions down a little bit more. But the fact is, this is just not nearly enough. And if this is our plan for the next 16 years in this country alone, it's not setting a good example, and it's not going to make a lick of difference, in my opinion. We need to do more. That's all there is to it.
So Taylor, maybe I can provide a bright light in that this week's Cosmos dealt with that pretty extensively. So at least there's...
I'm glad to hear that. I'm a little behind. I haven't caught up on this week yet.
Yeah, they... throughout the series, they've been talking about this, and this week's in particular, talked about this issue at length, and you know what the current science says about this, and you know where we are and where we are going to end up if we keep the trend. So at least there's somebody out there on a popular platform talking about the current day reality of this.
And there is a politician out there in a popular state who is preventing people from seeing this on broadcast television. They're actually censoring the episodes of Cosmos.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a pretty big platform, so at least we can take that as a consolation.
If you're not watching Cosmos, you totally should. It's amazing. It is very interesting and very entertaining.
And speaking of the cosmos, maybe we can explore them a little further. What do we got going on in the kicker here? We've got some space news, I see.
Yeah, this I really like this story. So we were tempted to lead with the SpaceX story as our kicker, but we picked another space story that is not getting as much press, but I think is so much more fun. Now, this almost feels like the plot of Star Trek the Motion Picture, don't you think?
Yeah, it's pretty out there.
So in the original Star Trek movie, an alien civilization comes back with the Voyager spacecraft and thinks that it is this lost, sad little remnant of a robot civilization, and they sort of soup it up and bring it back. This is not quite like that. There's no aliens involved. So the satellite that we're talking about
here... Not unless there's a
cover-up. ...is the International Sun-Earth Explorer 3. Was launched in 1978 and orbited the Earth for around a decade, around two decades actually, and was studying solar winds. And it was doing a great job at that, but eventually the mission to study solar winds was complete, and they made a course correction that put it into a path that would use the moon's gravity to fling it into orbit around the sun ahead of the Earth. So it's been moving faster than the Earth and getting ahead of it in the orbit for the last 16 years since 1998. Now, it spent those 16 years coming around, leading the Earth until it comes around to the backside. So it has nearly lapped us in 16 years. And so now it's coming back. And NASA always had a plan to reestablish contact with this satellite, the IC-3. But they don't have the money to do it anymore. Fortunately, terrestrial technology has advanced to the point where amateur enthusiasts are able to attempt to make contact with this satellite after 16 years. in cold space. And they did it. That's the best part. Last week, they announced that this team of amateurs making contact at the Arecibo Radio Observatory in Puerto Rico made contact with this satellite for the first time in 16 years.
That's pretty incredible. They say that they got a bit rate of 512 bits per second going through to the satellite after they
rebooted
it.
That's pretty fantastic for 1978 technology.
Yeah, Yeah. So, and they had to reboot it. That's the crazy thing.
That's really fast.
They basically put up a radio telescope and hacked the thing and had to reboot it and then were able to establish reliable communications with it. That's a pretty wild thing.
Well, now their next plan is to attempt to fire up the engines to get it to stick around Earth for a while, because if they can't fire up the engines, it will have to lay dormant for another 2 centuries.
Yeah, well, by then we'll just teleport it down here. That's not that big a deal.
Oh, right. Well, of course.
Yes. Well, you'd know better than I would, since you are a man of the future. Okay, I think that's show, Taylor.
I'm not teleporting yet, if that tells you anything.
Oh, so it's quite a long ways away. And you just violated the Prime Directive. So if somebody were to try to contact you about your Prime Directive violation, how would they go about doing so?
The first rule of the Prime Directive is you never talk about the Prime Directive. The second rule of the Prime Directive is confidential.
All right, so you you have no presence on the internet as a consequence here. So, well, if you wanted to get at me, I am at Chris Hale Barnes.
Not related to that, no.
All right, so let's get out of here for the week. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a look at Entertainment 2.0. They've got some very good Surface Pro 3 discussion on there. They've got CNN HD, the movie podcast, and Home On, who had the CEO and CTO of Insteon on there. So that's a pretty big podcast for Home On. It's great. Go listen to it. You can also send us some feedback. We've got our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. Together, we are at @theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.